The Forged and Unbroken podcast.
Sure. Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
Oh, that's amazing. You get to influence the next generation. That's obviously super important. Speaking of where you work, you're in a pretty fun location. So if you could, like, could you give us the basic rundown of, and you just said 20 years, you got 20 years with?
July of 2025, I'll have 20 years.
Oh, that's awesome.
With Albemarle. Yep.
Oh, very cool. So in April of 25, I'll hit my 20.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. All so right, we're right cool. there with each other. That's awesome. That's a huge benchmark, right?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Congrats. What are, when you explain Albemarle County, Virginia, how do you break that down? Like, give us the basic demographics of where you're at and what you do and see and serve.
Yeah, so Albemarle, if you're not familiar with it, we surround the city of Charlottesville, who also is a fire department mm-hmm. as well. And in the city of Charlottesville and Albemarle, it gets pretty like cheesy there, is the University of Virginia. So we have a lot of different dynamics of the types of people that live in Albemarle, and also a huge finances range. So we have some really heavy hitters that are super duper, like huge mansions on the hill, like overlooking. and then we have a lot of lower like income. We have a large homeless population as well. The Albemarle has a few stations, but we also have 24-hour houses, but then we have dynamics of daylight stations, and obviously the 24-hour houses are 24 hours, but the daylight stations are 12-hour stations, and that's one of the stations that I'm at. I am at Seminole Trail, and we have career staff there Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And then the volunteers take over at night and the weekends. Mm-hmm. And Seminole Trail, although it's not the only station to have UVA students, we have a high number of UVA students. They do a phenomenal job of recruiting students. So we have a lot of young folks that are volunteers there at night and weekends. We are in the, I'd have to say, the center of Albemarle, where we have a lot of high income and a lot of low income. We also have the highest number of assisted care facilities like nursing homes. We have a high population of elderly. We also have one of the highest areas of commercial. So we have it all.
Yeah.
We do. We have it all. And then also we're second pull for the interstate. So 64, Interstate 64 runs through Albemarle, Charlottesville area. And so we pull that. We have a high military population as well, because there's a National Ground Intelligence Center that's here. So we got a little bit of everything.
Yeah, that's actually very similar to where I'm at in Central Maryland. I see a lot of similarities there, and maybe not as much as the college town where I volunteered, a county south, you know, University of Maryland. There's definitely a lot of what you're talking about. I've never heard daylight that term before. That's pretty neat. Yeah. So yeah, so Albemarle is a combination system then.
Yes. With,
and Charlottesville, yep. All career.
Charlottesville is all career.
Got
yeah.
Okay.
They do have a few volunteers, but I think they're in different capacity than like Albemarle's volunteers are.
Got it. Yeah. Neat.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a neat area. I appreciate the recommendations last year when I took a road trip down there with some friends to, to check out the town. So it was cool. But so a little bit of a hard switch. You, last year gave me, but you approached me about it, and then we just did it here about a month ago. The very unique opportunity to hang out with you at Training Days in Alexandria, Virginia, to talk about mental health in the fire service, and we kind of rallied around this term of optimizing firefighter resiliency. Mm-hmm. And this is something that is absolutely near and dear to you. And you invited me into your space to join forces and put out the good word. And it seemed like it was really well received. And not to put the cart before the horse, but by the time we were done, and I think we're 48 hours after, we know of at least a half a dozen people that went and got some type of professional help. How cool is that? That's very humbling. And I know we felt pretty honored over being given that opportunity and seeing it get put to work. So let's start to pick this apart. Yeah, we had a really amazing stage and opportunity with Training Days, because it's a phenomenal group, and you had a lot of amazing things to say. And like I said, you've been in this space for a little while too. So I'll let you set it up with some of the work that you've been doing, and then we'll kind of start picking apart some of our discussion points from that day.
Yeah, man. It's awesome, right? Like, first off, what an honor to have Training Days invite us, you to come back again, because you killed it the year before. And then what a real honor to be able to talk about mental health and wellness in a fireman's space. Because that's not something that you usually hear when we talk about, I'm heading out to like a fireman's conference. Like, we're going to talk about like bro shit and like, you know, dragging hose lines and our knuckles and
yeah, talk about feelings.
Like that. Yeah. So like, I think we opened it up. We're about to talk about feelings. And a lot of people were like, what? And I was very worried because I was like, gosh, you know, these folks aren't coming here to talk about feelings. And, you know, where there's this huge misconception about mental health, and especially the fire service and being a first responder in mental health. You know, we all think that we're supposed to be untouchable and super tough and nothing's going to bother us. But in reality, shit does bother us, right? Like, and we have to start really taking care of our mental health, because that only makes us a better fireman. It only makes us a better first responder. And so it was really an honor to be able to talk about that. And like you said, it was really, really cool to feel that impact almost immediately, because like you said, you know, within 48 hours, we had people coming up to us saying, oh, you know, I've made appointments with clinicians. I recognized that I needed help. And just hearing you guys talk was all that I needed to reach out to somebody. And that right there, to me, took the worry away. Mm-hmm. That people weren't ready to receive it. And maybe not everybody did receive it. And that's something that I had to think about in my mind. Like, Suzanne, if there's 300 people there and 299 people think you're full of shit, but one person, like, you help one person, then we did our job, right? And it turns out we helped more than that one person. So, which is good, which is really good. So, it was a really great experience.
Yeah. It was cool to give high fives and hugs there towards the end. Like, hey, we did it. I know for myself, I was, it was nerve wracking at times, because, you know, I come in doing line of duty Mayday stuff. And then the next year I did, Mayday readiness and talking about science and tactics. And then we're coming in like, let's talk about feelings and mental health and how to, you know, prop yourself up. I'm like, oh, and of course, I think Mac is trying to kill us, because it's, you know, first day, first one, right? They're all amped to hear about fire stuff. And here we are doing this. But I'm totally with you. That really resonated with me when you said that. And, you know, be able to create some change there for even one person, you know, it hopefully changed things for the better for them, and it affected many people. So that's super cool and really honorable. And when we opened it, we talked about how the goal here is to build durable, resilient humans, right? And I broke it down with durability, meaning to exist for a long time without significant deterioration in quality or value. So how noble of a goal is that for the fire service and as a human? And then resiliency, just being able to recover from any type of hardship and being able to adjust on the fly. And this isn't, I want to be very clear with a lot of this, that what we're going to talk about is not a replacement for professional work, right? These are the skills and activities and knowledge and hopefully the daily discipline and what will become your anchors in life to support the system and yourself. And when that doesn't happen, that's okay. There are still other avenues out there for you through therapy and professional work. I know I've benefited from like EMDR and behavioral therapy. Like there's a ton of resources out there, and even the, what we're about to talk about, like still please continue to see and support and look out for those other resources that are out there.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and I always tell people like those types of treatments and the different clinicians, they're really, you're interviewing them, right? As much as they're trying to help you. So not every shoe is going to fit every single person. And so really you should try on a counselor and a clinician like you try on pants. If they don't fit you, move on to the next pair of pants that like make your booty pop. I don't know, right? Like, so you have to find what works for you. And you can't go off of what works for somebody else. And that's why it was so awesome that you had all those examples. And then I had examples. And then together, we just brought them together. And I think we gave people a lot of really good ideas that I hope that someone can pick out something that works best for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's... Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, and definitely seek out the people that are going to, that you resonate with. I've certainly had friends, close friends go through therapy and actually been given really bad advice or bad skills. And that's just like any profession, there's a bell curve of quality, right? And it's the same thing exists in behavioral health and in psychology and therapy. So, if the first one doesn't jive, it doesn't feel right, you know, keep on the path, but, I know you came out the gate hot. And what I mean is you have, unfortunately, the experience of suicide within your department. And it was with people that you knew were struggling, and it was with people that you had no idea. And the delta between those two is pretty massive, right? So if you would do us the honor, talking about, you know, opening up with a heavy topic. Go ahead.
We definitely did open up with that heaviness, because realistically, mental health and suicide, in general, they are heavy, right? And, so in our department, unfortunately, we have had two firemen, take their own lives. They lost their battle with mental health, and took their own lives almost 4 years apart, within a couple of weeks of each other. The first fireman, Clinton. Clinton was just all smiles all the time. And a lot of times the people that are struggling the most are the ones that do seem the most positive and upbeat and happy. And that's why we talked about getting to know your people and knowing what makes them tick and their family and their interests, so that we can know really truly when they're struggling, so that we can like peel back those layers and get in there. Because a lot of people that didn't know Clinton didn't know he was struggling, but for the most part, the guys on his shift and people in the peer support group, we knew he was struggling. And so I'd like to say that him taking his life wasn't a surprise, but it really was, even though we knew he was struggling. The second person was just this year in 2024. Again, he was almost a few weeks shy of 4 years exactly. And his name was Micah. And Micah, no one knew he was struggling. He hit it very, very well. He'd been struggling since he was young. And there was just one day a catalyst for him that made him take his own life. And he was a complete surprise. So we have two different ends of the spectrum, right? We have a fireman who, for the most part, most people knew were struggling. And then we had a fireman who no one knew he was struggling. And it hit different people differently. There's sometimes when you know people are struggling and you find out that they take their own life, you feel like, could I have done anything differently? Could I have done more? Could we have reached out more? And the not funny, haha, obviously, but the funny thing is about a person who you have no clue that is struggling, you ask the same questions. Mm-hmm. Could I have done more? Should I have asked more questions? Should I have gotten to know him better? And so even though those are two totally different ends, the same questions were asked. And so if I had to say one thing other than we have to break this stigma of mental health, you have to get to know your people. Sometimes they're not going to show you. We talked about being an iceberg. Like, imagine yourself as an iceberg. What we want people to see is above the water, right? It's that iceberg that you see. But a lot of times we don't show other people what's under the water. And I think sometimes those people, if they don't want you to know, Micah, right? Then they're just not going to show you. And so every time there's a suicide, it leaves us with unanswered questions, no matter if we knew they were struggling or if we didn't know. It's brought people in our department closer. And, you know, Clinton was the catalyst, really Clinton, the first fireman that took his life, in 2020, he's why I'm here. I landed in this peer support space, right around the time Clinton took his life. And, it just sent me through we don't have enough of this. We don't have enough peer support. We don't have enough mental health training. And so for 4 years, it's been a big push. And some ways it's been easy, the things that we've gotten, and some ways it's been, we take 10 steps forward and then we take 9.5 steps back. And so, because it is, we can't see it, right? Like we see a broken leg, and immediately you're like, oh, what can we do? Like, how can we support you? Obviously it's a broken leg. Let's do everything we can. Let's give you the time off. Let's give you support. But mental health, we can't see it. And so when we can't see something, it makes it, for some people, harder to support and harder to believe in. And that's the stigma that we need to break, that we work so hard for, to bring light to, because those people need support as well.
Yeah, that's a great analogy of like a broken bone or an injury, right? It's face forward. It's, you know, not hard to miss, but there is rest and recovery involved. And after you get past that, there is PT and there's strengthening and there are things to support the growth. And when it's not healed correctly, that just leads to more issues on the back end of things. But when you do the correct things, the correct strengthening and the correct PT and the correct healing, you come back stronger, right? That bone heals stronger. And that's such a interesting analogy for mental health. It works the exact same way, but because you can't see it, it's, you know, it's easily bypassed. And I know for a lot of departments out there, but finding a behavioral health specialist can sometimes be hard to come by or just hard to support. Some departments are doing it and are doing it really well and they're seeing the benefits. And there's other departments that do it and like, hey, cool, we've checked the box now because we have somebody on staff or whatever the case may be. But there's so much more involved with it, right? So
yeah, definitely. We're really lucky because we have an amazing clinician on staff. But we had to fight for her. Not because of the department, but because the finances and proving that she would be utilized. And she's become really invested in our department. She does ride along. She stops by the stations. She's been an amazing resource, but we had to work to get her.
We're pretty similar. We have one on staff and she's absolutely amazing. And, I just hope that she's getting all the support that she deserves because she's doing great things. Getting into some of the data now that we've come out the gate hot, what does the data actually say about PTSD in the fire service? So, and there's a lot of sublayers to this and PTSD, for example, 1 out of 5 firefighters are going to meet PTSD criteria at some point in their career. Over 2/3 of EMS professionals don't have enough time to recover in between calls. A major driving cause of PTSD is self-perception and shame. And I'll kind of expand on that in a second. There's substance abuse, very common sublayer of PTSD. 50% of male firefighters have talked about binge drinking at some point. 40% of females, so not too far behind. The suicide, which you've touched on, it's approximately 1 to 200 firefighter suicides per year, but you mentioned this, you have to self-report typically. So that number is probably undershot big time, right? Unfortunately. Yeah. Suicide ideation is at 10 times the rate of the general population. So just thinking about suicide or mulling over the possibility of it, 10 times the rate of the general population. Something that we experience that a lot of other people don't is moral injury. So over half of firefighters experience this. And those are things like mass shootings, severe trauma to body, like injuries incompatible with life, injuries, trauma, abuse to children or aged populations. And a big one is lack of preparedness, whether it's your skills or skills for somebody on your team. Not knowing if you're capable of doing the job can lead to PTSD. There's individual contributing factors, so obesity. Some of this is fire service, but also just the American population. 1/3 are obese, another 1/3 are overweight. So that's 2/3 of the American population can be considered overweight or obese, unfortunately. There's physical stress, like heat stress and heat burden. There's workload and durations, just being in our gear. And if you can't compensate well or if you can't work through that, that has led to PTSD, like supporting the things that are going to support PTSD, poor metabolic factors. So lack of physical preparedness with your training regimen, poor nutrition in the fire service. You know, that's pretty obvious. And then that one of hiding from expertise. So there are people that are, make mistakes on the fire round or there's no accountability. And with that, oh my goodness, what did I do with my screen? Going back to what I mentioned before is that bit of validation. So unfortunately, there are groups of people, and I certainly experienced this after our line of duty, that if they were not prepared themselves, they went through a bit of a little, like somewhat of a crisis in that they were not prepared for the job. And you take one of two roads. You either hide or you nurture those skills through physical training, through occupational training, and you do the things to prepare for that readiness. And that's a daily grind. And if you don't keep up with that, some laziness or honestly just rolling the dice and gambling on whether or not, hey, am I going to be tested on this next call? And a lot of people just roll the dice. And then when that call does happen, they're not in a position to affect any change. And that hits really, really hard for some people, unfortunately. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll hit on, and I'll throw it back to you, are some of the organizational contributing factors. So there are a lot of leadership issues that come into play of toxic organizational culture, not feeling psychologically safe within your team to maybe speak up or push the envelope for higher quality or higher standards. There's a betrayal of trust, obviously personnel shortages, abuse of the 911 system, and then just lack of access to resources. These are all things that are issues among the fire service that lead to PTSD. So I guess what we're going to get into now is kind of like choosing your heart, right? This is, are we going to abuse substances? Are we not going to train? Are we not going to work out? Are we going to sit on the couch? Or are we going to do those things that I call any number of things like daily discipline, your non-negotiables, your anchors, your core values? What are the things that you are supporting every day to help support you in this profession, right? So all of it's hard. You just got to pick which one is going to be for you, right?
So I think so. All of that is really hard, but it's just about what you want your outcome to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Simply put. So let's start talking about some of these anchors, right? You kind of opened the floor with brain health, right? Yeah. And how the mind, like you had, I'll just throw this in there really quick. We were laughing because my slides are like my speaking points, my note pages, right? And you could just go for, you have one picture and then you could just go for 10 minutes. And I'm envious of that. So here's your picture of the brain, you know, it's up on the screen and then you can go. So I'll let you open the floor with that.
Yeah. So the brain health, obviously, right? Like it's so important. And it's just multifaceted. And we talked about all things brain, and I feel like the whole presentation that we did can just stem from like that brain photo. we talked about how we deal with compound trauma. Our brain doesn't develop fully until we're 27. And so when we have these young guys and gals, right? We have these young firemen who are seeing things, and it's a compound, the compound calls, that just bunch together. And like you said, we aren't taking good care of ourselves in between the calls. So having good brain health and taking care of yourself is so important. I'm trying to remember what else we talked about.
There was one piece where, you know, you know how I nerd out on the science. And the Dr. Andrew Huberman not too long ago talked about the anterior mid cingulate cortex, the AMCC. And from a primal standpoint, the AMCC, it's located probably in the prefrontal cortex, is this area of the brain that was set up more so for survival. And so this area would light up if you had to go run and expend energy for food. Or maybe it was for a threat. So that means if you have to expend energy, that's calories burnt. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a position where you can't get calories back, then that could mean life or death. or if you had to go chase down, you know, food, or if there was some danger, or if there was just some hard physical activity, again, energy expenditure. So if you don't have to do that activity, then your AMCC is saying, all right, well, don't do that. We need you to save these calories for other things. Now, fast forward, you know, millennia, we haven't adapted well to that in that we have a ton of conveniences in life now. Yeah. It is, when we zoom out, there really is not a ton of hardship. And I don't mean to water down anybody's personal experiences, but we have it pretty good right now. And so the AMCC, when it lights up, it's at times telling you, hey, don't work hard because that can mean injury or death through that energy expenditure. But what they're coming to find out now, though, is that when you do hard things, you can literally light that part of your brain up, and it leads to wellness, resiliency, grit, perseverance, motivation, and even further energy expenditure, because you're actually teaching your brain that, no, this struggle is okay. It's actually making me better. Yeah. I'm still in this safe environment through the hardship, and now it's adapting you for further struggle. So you're actually that 0 to 10 scale that we use in the fire service or in EMS that now gets broadened, and our struggle and what we're able to overcome and adapt to becomes broadened. And that's actually physiologically happening in the brain. So I think that's pretty damn important for what we do.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like we're going to talk about breathing and breathing techniques a little bit later. But, you know, part of a first responders, among a lot of things, one of the things that I find that we struggle with the most is a heightened sense of awareness, anxiety, and that comes from those back-to-back-to-back calls, right? And when we talk about our parasympathetic versus our sympathetic, when we're constantly in that fight or flight, it's hard to come down from that. And so we have to work on techniques to be able to bring ourselves down out of that fight or flight. And there's so many different ways, right? I feel like I said, we're probably going to talk about breathing and then the fitness. I'm a big proponent of, you know, take it or leave it, right? People are either for it or they're against it. But I'm a huge proponent of trying to recreate the extremes that we're going to find in a call, right? So like a great example is I really hate to love working out in gear because of so many different things, but we'll just hone in on what it does for my mind. Working out in gear, no matter what, it's limiting. So it limits your motion, your range of motion. It limits the ability to let go of heat, right? Because your gear traps heat. And mentally, that really helps me because I know that I can just tell myself, Suzanne, stop being dramatic. you are going to be okay. You're just uncomfortable. And the more that you put yourself in that environment, the more that you come out of it on the other end, 100% certain, yeah, I could do this. I got this all day long. And I know that because I just did this yesterday, or 6 months ago, I did this really tough workout and I thought there's no way I can do it. It's hot. It's humid. Like here, Virginia, right? Like Jenny, oh, Jenny, she's terrible in the summer. She's got humidity that will not quit. And so it sucks to suck, right? But every time I finish a workout or a task, not only am I proud of myself, not only do I know that I'm working towards making myself a better fireman, a more dependable, reliable fireman, I am doing amazing things for my mental health. I know this isn't about that, but I remember your first training days. in Alexandria, where you talked about the preparation that you did to make you be as successful as you could be during your May Day situation, your writ, your May Day situation. And that just resonated with me, because I was like, man, this guy gets it, right? And so I fully believe in trying to control that setting and put myself in that so that I know that I have a better chance of succeeding, and bringing myself out of that sympathetic, that fight or flight.
Yeah.
And knowing how to do that.
You are like embracing that struggle. You are intentionally putting yourself in the position to realize that gain potential, right? You want to know what your potential is. And I think the unfortunate side is that there's a lot of people, humans and fire service, that don't do that. And so they don't realize what their potential is or what they're actually capable of doing. And then when they meet that really crazy event, they've never experienced that before. And going back to the stress response, like you talked about, that constant stress response is maladaptive. So you actually begin to affect your overall health deleteriously because you're just constantly letting cortisol be present in the body. There's a good book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And like, if you were to take this entire 300-page book, it's basically saying when animals get chased and then they run away from it and then they're back in a safe environment, their cortisol drops and they're back to normal because they ran away from the threat and it's no longer present.
Yeah.
As humans, we're terrible at that because we ruminate and we think about, well, what if? And then you start to rethink about what had happened. You're like, man, that was close. And then you constantly just have that cortisol present in your body. Right. And then you lay down at night and you're just staring at the ceiling like, man, I almost got. And sustained cortisol in the body starts affecting your immunity. It affects your heart health. Mm-hmm. You can literally die from stress. It affects all areas of physical health, which also affects mental health. So digging further into this, you had, as we get into some of the physical attributes and some of the skills that we can use, you talked about the stress bucket, in the responder stress continuum. So it's a really good analogy to set up what we're about to talk about.
Yeah. The stress continuum is just a really, I call it a fireman proof picture to tell you whether you're stressed or not, right? So it's a green, yellow, orange, and red. And each category has different signs and symptoms. And it's to help you recognize whether you're stressed or you're critical. And it also helps you recognize whether the people that are in your life are in that green or that red. So obviously it escalates from green to red, and green is just a baseline. We're happy. We show up to shift and we're happy to be there. Maybe we have a little bit of struggle, but we compensate from that very well. The yellow is most of us hit into that yellow at least once a day. And because we all have life stressors, maybe it's training or we run a nasty call, but that from that yellow, we compensate. We don't compensate, but we work through it, probably work through it a bit healthy in a healthy way. And we move right back down into that green. The orange is where we start to enter into the sleep issues, the increase of maybe alcohol, the increase or the beginning of maybe some like drug intake, family issues. We start to have habits that we don't normally have. So like if we're normally a worker outer person, then we start to lose that. Well, I don't really feel like working out today. And it starts to compound. At some point in our lives, every one of us goes into that orange but it's what we do in that orange that makes the difference. So when you're in that orange, it's critical. And you can, like you said before, you can either go one way or the other, right? So ideally, we want to take that turn towards counseling, towards trying to increase our sleep, getting out of that sleep debt, trying to work on our nutrition, putting down the alcohol, talking to someone, whether that be like a peer supporter or a family member. If you have a faith-based person that you want to go see, you can take that route. But if you don't, 100% of the time, you're going to move into the red. And the red is where we start to see broken relationships, broken marriages. We start to see anxiety and depression move on to PTSD. And then the end all be all is from the suicidal thoughts that we may start to have. The red is where we see firemen start taking their lives. So you can either go this way or that way. And hopefully we go the way of the healthy response. But it's easier said than done.
Yeah.
Because when we're in the orange is when we start to feel alone. And feeling alone that's huge. That's why it's so important. Again, I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, but it's so important to get to know your people and provide them a safe space. I always tell people that if you ask about how their 4-day break went or whatever your break looks like, and you truly invest in them and they feel invested in and like you care about the little things, then they're going to feel like they can come to you with the big things.
Yeah.
And so it's so important that you get to know your people and provide them with a safe space. And that's everything. That's administration. That's your officer. That's the other fireman on your shift. And it doesn't even have to be like the senior man. It can be the new guy too. So like new guys count too, right?
Yeah.
But it's so important. So yeah, that's the stress continuum in a long-winded nutshell.
Yeah. And something that you just mentioned, I remembered, in building connection, sometimes it's hard to know where to begin. And I've done this with a couple different groups of people where you use the Ford model and it's family, occupation, recreation, or dreams. Mm. And it's a really cool way you can be formal about it and go through the Ford, or you can just, hey, off the cuff, check in with somebody and just pick one out and be like, you know, recreation. Hey, how was your weekend this weekend? What did you and the family get into? Or, hey, like, hey, what are some of your hobbies? Like, what are some of your interests outside of work or family? Like, hey, how's your kid doing? I heard that they were sick last week. Everybody healing up? And then you start, it helps you design questions to create further connection. So that way you can pick up on the red flags easier. Or when you start talking, like, ooh, you're going through a tough time in your life right now. You know, I'm glad we now have this baseline relationship where we kind of know some things about each other and we know when things are not in sync. Right. So that's a cool way of doing that.
But yeah.
The stress bucket, it was a cool analogy. Like, It basically talks, it's like input output, right? So you got your bucket. Sometimes I've heard it also called the bathtub analogy, where you're just constantly putting stress in. You know, we have all these stressful inputs through personal and professional life. Yeah. And your bandwidth, your resiliency to be able to overcome those is, you know, how big your bucket is. Some people may have a little cup, some people may have a 50-gallon drum. And then how many faucets you have or the size of your faucet are your skills on the back end. So as that bucket fills up, you can open these faucets through working out, through talking to somebody, listening to good music, whatever your self-care things might be, you can start draining that stress. Because if you don't have a healthy amount of skills, maybe you don't have skills at all to be able to overcome those stressful inputs, it's going to overflow. And when you overflow, like you talked about, that's when you're getting to the orange and the red, or, if for nothing else, using a water analogy, like it's going to overflow. It's going to damage mm-hmm. everything around you. You know, it yeah. seeps into areas that you don't want it to seep in, right? Water can get everywhere, and stress is very similar to that. Kind of going into the water thing, let's get into these physical attributes. We opened up with cold water immersion, right? So using yeah. sticking with the water theme.
Love to hate it.
Yeah, let's hit on that real quick.
Yeah, so I love ice baths.
Yeah.
I have so many, for me, like you read the studies and they're like, oh, you know, it decreases inflammation, it increases your recovery, the quickness of your recovery, mental health. Yeah, all the things. For me, what I've noticed is usually I do it about an hour after I work out because that's how long it takes me to stretch, to cool down, to gossip with the guys, like talk smack about the other shift, you know, that kind of thing. I love that I've noticed on a physical level that I'm less sore. Typically, I get sore 2 days after my DOMS, if yep. you will, my delayed onset muscle soreness is usually 2 days after. And when I started to do the ice baths, I noticed that although I was still sore, it was less. And so that is a physical thing that happens to me. But mostly what I like to do is I'm just super weird. And I like to put myself in these terrible, like, mental trying situations where I'm like, oh man, this is going to be terrible, but I'm going to do it. Because I want to prove to myself that I can do it. And I know the ice bath is like just a small thing, but I like to do it. So every day I'll hop in the ice bath. Usually it's around 30 or 35. Degrees. I know there's tons of science about different temperatures, but that's what I like. That's just the right amount of, this is terrible.
That's cold. That's cold, girl.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right around the exact amount of like, holy shit, this is terrible. Why are you doing this? I drop in and I give myself no other option except no, we're freaking doing this. Because we can, because you can, and you're gonna do this. I drop in and immediately it takes my breath away. And that is exactly when the breathing techniques kick mm-hmm. in. And immediately right now, it's it used to be something that I had to work at, like remind myself, oh shit, yeah, that's right, breathe through this. But because I've done so much, that automatic response for me is breathe, you're fine, it's okay. And I can I track the ice baths on my Whoop mm-hmm. and you can almost see my heart rate start to lower more I settle in and the more I work through my breathing. I also really enjoy it because while you're in that, just like a workout that is really, really terrible, all I can think about is the breathing. So it clears my mind. I don't think about any to-do lists, any issues that I've been having, any worries. That's why I like the ice bath.
Yeah, I know for me, it's also increased my tidal volume. I breathe clearer and fuller. My sinuses have cleared up. There is a natural dopamine release. I totally feel it. And if I can time it well with my coffee, like I get a great dopamine hit, like between caffeine and like the ice bath, like I'm feeling like a rock star. But there's also a fire ground application too, of you're in a really hard position and you are taking control of your breath. And that's super huge. If you have never in training gotten to the point of where you're bleeding, your bottle completely dry, the bell's ringing, and you still have more work to do. And oh crap, you're in your last 200 PSI of air. And now you have to effectively manage it with a high heart rate. Like that's a major life-saving skill as well. And I've done that with my shift, in the past, so that way they understand that dynamic of being on, being redlined and having to take back control of your breath, right? And a couple protocols.
I was just going to say, because like it's all fun and games until that bell starts to sound.
Mm-hmm.
And you know you still have work left. And that's a mental shift that you have to do for yourself, because no matter, I feel like, and maybe not everyone agrees, but I feel like no matter how seasoned you are, no matter how many times you've trained, when you start, when that first bell goes off, there's an immediate like spike of shit, my bell just went off, you know? And then the practice is just what you do after that.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that's why, that's awesome that you do that with your crew. That's cool.
That's cool. And a couple of protocols, the gold standard, I mean, there are so many different studies and you can find a ton of things out there. The gold standard is 11 minutes per week. Like you don't need to do anything super crazy. You can, just like with anything, you can do it too much, right? So if you're sitting in this thing for 30 minutes every single day, that's probably not healthy. And you're also shunting a healthy inflammation response. Like you're almost shutting it down. There, and some inflammation is good because that's how your body's literally healing. And so if you shut that off completely, you might feel good for a little bit, but on the back end, you're not actually going to recover well. If you're somebody who's completely new to it, starting at like 59 degrees, 30 to 60 seconds. And then for me, I know like just over time you start to adapt. So you just keep bringing the temperature down. You can keep going longer and work towards where you're at, the 30 to 35 degrees, which is like baller status. That's awesome. So yeah, just as you adapt, yeah, get in there. But you can't have cold without the hot. So also a big fan of hot therapies, and especially for what we do, the uncompensable heat stress, heat stroke and heat exhaustion are massive contributors to near misses, line of duty injury, maydays. So when you do hot therapy, you are taking better control of your heart rate. You can actually drop your resting heart rate. And when you're doing work, your heart rate can stay at a lower level. Your core temperature decreases. On the fire ground, oftentimes you can get to a point where you come out of the environment, out of the superheated, you know, fire scenario that we're in. And even when you downdress, your core temp can still rise degrees after coming out. You think you're cooling down. So you think you're doing the right thing and you are still behind the eight ball. So you can actually drop your core temp through hot therapy. Your work output and your ratings of perceived exertion your work output goes up and your perceived exertion goes down through work. You can work longer. You introduce heat shock proteins into your body, and heat shock proteins are valuable because that's what helps support cardiac health, muscular health. They're also, heat therapies also aid in what's called apoptosis. So you actually damage heat shock protein cells, can lend itself to binding to other molecules, like getting nerding out on the science. And that's where some of the cancer precursors can come into play. So I'm not sitting here shutting down saying like you're going to save yourself from cancer. But what I am saying is that you can actually destroy the unhealthy cells faster through hot immersion, and just your overall tolerance to heat stress goes up. And so a couple of things, like if you have access to a hot tub, if you can do 104 degrees for 30 to 40 minutes a couple times a week, that's amazing. If you have access to a dry sauna, like a hot air, ambient air temperature environment, you can start as low as like in the 130s. Over time, ideally you climb up to almost near 200, if you can tolerate 200. And I've seen everything from 30 to 45 minutes, upwards of multiple hours. I think for what we do, what's a common lower barrier to entry for normal life, you know, once or twice a week for 45 to 60 minutes. I know I like to incorporate ice baths in with that. So I'll do 200 degrees for 15 minutes, ice bath for 2 to 3 minutes. And I just do that for 15 minute intervals until I get 60 to 90 minutes. And I feel like a rock star. But it's pretty awesome. And the research is pretty abundantly clear on this. And a quick shout out for myself. I have that Extremist Readiness podcast. I do deep dives on the science of that, and that's all in there. So you can check that out.
I love it. Yeah. I love your nerdness.
I was a total nerd. Yeah, fully embraced it. Switching gears, let's talk about meditation.
Yeah. When I'm in the ice bath, when you breathe or you do those breathing exercises, realistically, like, you are meditating. And so every day that I do an ice bath, I like check that little box. Yep, meditated today. But meditation is so amazing for so many different reasons. But if we want to apply it to the fire ground and the fire service in general, when we meditate, we help lower the cortisol, right? Like, we lower our cortisol, which lowers our just compound stress that seems to be the nasty thing that we deal with. We don't come down from those calls, and especially if we have back-to-back calls. And it, when we meditate, it doesn't have to be 10 minutes or 5 minutes. If you do a breathing technique for 1 minute, if that's all you have, that is amazing. Some meditation is better than no meditation at all. And you're rightfully so teaching your body to relax and have control over your brain and your thoughts. I love doing guided meditations, but I love to hate silent meditation. That for me is a freaking nightmare, but because it forces you to control your freaking thoughts. Yeah. Right? Like, guided meditation, that to me is so easy. I love it. Not easy, like I'm poo-pooing it at all. I love guided meditation. That's what I do quite often. But the silent meditation for me is where I really have to control my thoughts.
It forces you to have to focus on
it
them.
It does. Yeah. It does.
It's very
yeah,
easy to shut them up or let them yeah. be intrusive, and it forces you to tackle them head on.
Yes, exactly. Man, which is tough because we're really bad about facing stuff head on. We like to just sweep it under the rug for another day.
Yeah, we'll skirt right around that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's fine. I'm good. But that in itself is what causes us to fill our stress bucket with stress.
Yeah.
So if we go back to that stress bucket, then the meditation is a form of the faucet that releases that, not the faucet that fills, but yeah. the faucet that releases that stress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so many of these things that we've talked about with choosing your hard, you know, it's meditation is being mindful. So being present in the moment, yeah. pay attention to what your thoughts are saying and doing. And when you're doing hard things, that is also a form of meditation. So when you're working out hard enough to where you can't think of anything else but that, or when you're in the ice bath and you can only focus on those things, one, you're teaching yourself how to hit a flow state easier. But that in and of itself is a bit of a meditation because you're focusing yeah. solely on the activity and the struggle and the work instead of letting all these external influences, you know, overwhelm you. So that is a form of meditation. And then when you can also take control of your thoughts in a controlled setting, when you're by yourself and there's nobody else there but you and your thoughts and having to tackle them head on, it's just highly valuable. You know, it's hard work and you're sitting completely still. And
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I know for me, I introduce breath work into meditation. I bring it into the hot and cold immersion. And just a couple really quick ones. There's different types of breathing and they're super easy to access, right? So there's 5-5-5 breathing, and that's 5 second inhale, 5 second hold, 5 second exhale. And that's been shown to drop your heart rate, drop your blood pressure, drop inflammation, drop cortisol. The 5-2-8, so breathe in for 5, hold for 2, breathe out for 8. That increases focus. It calms your sympathetic nervous system and also drops your heart rate. Popularized by the Navy SEALs, there's the box breathe and the 4-4-4-4. So in for four, hold for four, out for four, hold for another four, and they just repeat that. That also calms the nervous system, increases focus. You know, they do that. That was like a popular thing that they did pre-mission. And then at night, there's some cool research. If you are trying to bring on sleep faster, like if you're getting stuck ruminating, and you're just having trouble sleeping, to calm yourself down, a 4-7-8. So breathe in for four, hold for seven, breathe out for eight is great for helping to induce sleep and lower anxiety. And then I know for me on the fire ground, or if I'm just anxious for whatever is going on in my life, the double sharp inhale or the psychological sigh is really awesome in just creating overall calm and also blowing off excess CO2 when you've been doing more shallow breathing. It's helped me on the fire ground. And then people see it or do it all the time without realizing, like when your kid gets really upset and they're like doing the thing, like they're breathing in, that's just the body's natural reaction of doing the psychological sigh. So you breathe in really sharp twice through your nose, like, and then really lengthen out the exhale. And the research on that has been super cool and it's very primal. This is where I started getting into some of the physical side of things, and I'll just breeze through this really quick because I know I can get long-winded. I'll hit the cliff notes, and if I start not making sense, just stop me. Why this is so important to me, and you know, one of the main reasons you brought help, you know, you invited me into this space was talking about the physical activity. And so many people, I think it's really easy to specialize in our lives. And what I mean is, you know, we might have the person that runs marathons and that's their thing, or we have the person that's a bodybuilder and that's their thing. And those are all good. Like I'm here for any physical activity, but the problem is that on the fire ground, when we are in these really bad environments, to be truly successful, you have to hit anaerobic work. And that's where we need all these different worlds to meet. You need to be able to lift heavy weights and run and do it all really quickly because that's the fire ground. So when we're in these really tough situations, we're going to be in these anaerobic stages, meaning without oxygen. So we're using naturally occurring sugar in our body or the naturally occurring creatine in our bodies to power these workouts. So these are high intensity, shorter duration. You bounce between them. Sometimes it's aerobic, but when things get really bad or really tough, really hard, you're not going to be working aerobically, right? So what does that look like? Max theoretical heart rate is 220 minus your age. So for me, I'm almost 40. That's 180 beats per minute, right? That's what the textbooks are saying is my max heart rate. I shouldn't be above that. Things go bad if I get above that. Now, when you switch from using oxygen being the like slow jog in your neighborhood, it's easy. You can do it for an hour at a time. You can hold a conversation while you're doing it. From the point where you go from that to anaerobic, where like, oh, I'm burning now sugar, I'm not using oxygen, I'm talking in short sentences, is getting really difficult, I might have to take some quick little breaks and resets. That's 180 minus your age. So for me, being almost 40, now that's happening at 140 beats per minute. And that's not hard to get to on the fire ground, right? And I have some data here to talk about that. So what are the benefits and the research supporting high intensity interval training? And the reason we're talking about HIIT training is that is the thing that's supporting the anaerobic work. Mm-hmm. So when you work out with high intensity interval training, it controls hypertension. So you can actually control blood pressure. And I'm just going to, I know here I nerded out on the research, so I'm just going to hit it really quick so we can get in and get out.
Yeah, no, I love it. Yeah. I love it though.
But, so HIIT training, you can control your hypertension and actually drop your blood pressure. So you have your normal resting state. Type 2 diabetes. I've been a strength and conditioning coach in the CrossFit world and HIIT training for, 15 years almost now. And I've seen numerous people come in on medication, type 2 diabetics, and by changing their eating to whole foods, nutrient dense foods, and doing HIIT training, we get them off of medication completely and they're no longer diabetics. Like how massive of a life change and shift is that so we can actually erode the type 2 markers. You decrease rates of obesity. You get greater exercise tolerance. You improve VO2 max. Human growth hormone. You can naturally secrete human growth hormone at higher percentages with HIIT training. So you can actually elevate your HGH naturally for upwards of 2 hours later. There was cool research, like if you did a 30-second all-out sprint compared to a 6-second all-out sprint, like if you were to go to the pain cave a little bit longer and do 30-second wind sprints, they increased human growth hormone by 450% more than by doing like a 6-second sprint. So just go to the pain cave a little bit longer, right?
Yeah.
testosterone. This is something I'm seeing some bad trends emerge right now, and it's the quick fix for testosterone. So I'm seeing it all over the nation, but even now in fire department circles, there's even fire department companies like saying, hey, we can get you access to testosterone. People are going in, they're getting their T checked, and it's low. That is a red flag. It shouldn't be these crazy drops throughout your life. It's very small fractions or percentage drops throughout your life. If you're eating well, if you're sleeping well, and we have a lot of things against us, right? Stress drops it, interrupted sleep drops it, lack of physical activity drops it. Like there's all kinds of things working against us, but because of, I see it, I actually know of people that like, well, no, I found this on TikTok from bodybuilders. People are taking SSRIs and they're getting testosterone because it's the quick fix. You know, it suppresses appetite. Hey, I'm going to bring up my tea. I'm going to get the patch or the shot or the pill or whatever. But it's the quick fix because they're not doing the work. What I'm advocating for is do the hard thing, eat the right food, try to get your rest and recovery, do the hard workouts, and you're going to bring your tea up naturally. And that's the more effective way than just going and taking the pill. If you're completely bottomed out and need that leg up, go for it. But if you haven't been doing the hard things, the right things, and you're just going to get the pill, I'll go as far as saying like, that's the lazy man's way. Like, please do the hard thing. You can naturally increase your testosterone, you know, with all the things. I work in busy companies. I got 2 kids. I get poor sleep. I don't recover well, but I'm doing all these other things that we're talking about. And my testosterone is totally fine and I'm not supplementing. So please get out there. HIIT training in women, fatty acid oxidation in your body and building skeletal muscle can increase by 36% after like 2 weeks. It was cool research. Women actually work harder when you look at it from a cardiovascular standpoint of heart rate and VO2 max. Basically, women can go to the pain cave more than men. Like you're just stronger and more resilient, whereas men's rating of perceived exertion were much higher. But when you look at the actual work metabolically, we weren't doing as much work. So shout out to the women out there. You're doing awesome things when you do HIIT training. White blood cell count. So just your overall immunity goes up. I'm just gonna keep breezing through this. And then mental health, what we talked about, you increase your glutamate and GABA. And when you decrease that, your GABA is when you start getting into depression and anxiety realms. That's when SSRIs start getting prescribed. You can boost your BDNF, your brain derived neurotrophic factor. And these are all things that are going to help with cognitive function, cellular repair, mood regulation, high level executive functioning, which is massive importance on the fire ground, right? Being able to have and keep and maintain high level thinking. And when BDNF drops, you actually start to exhibit bipolar symptoms, like in severe cases. So HIIT training can actually support that. And then kind of closing that up, heat burden. You can, I mentioned this earlier, you can push the higher core temps. You can do more work faster and handle the core temperature increase when you do high intensity interval training. And it's this like synonymous relationship where you do the hot water immersion, you do the cold water immersion, you do the HIIT training, and it makes you more resilient in your gear. So you're less likely to experience heat stress and heat stroke. And then your VO2 max is just energy expenditure. Your oxygen consumption. What they found was that like elite athletes, like the old school Gatorade commercials, when they're humming on the treadmill and they're sweating the orange sweat or whatever, and they're hooked up to the lab machine. It takes elite athletes a very long time, sometimes hours, many minutes to get up to their peak VO2 max. And then all of a sudden, and once they hit, they're like, they're spent and it drops off quick. What they're finding with HIIT training is that you can get to your max VO2 max very quickly, maintain it for long durations of time, doing a bunch of different type of work, and then you can recover really quickly also. So that was of massive importance. That was research from Pepperdine University where your VO2 max can just go to what was thought to be an elite level. You can maintain that for a really long time and just do a crazy amount of work across a ton of different domains where originally they thought you had to be this elite athlete and it took you a long time to get there. And then once you're done, right?
Yeah.
So all this HIIT training for the street side of things, a unit of measurement could be METs or metabolic equivalent. And however many METs you produce is kind of the difficulty of work that you're accumulating. So let's say zero METs or like 0.9 METs is sleeping. Like you're not doing any work. About every 5 to 6 METs could be a different zone. So a lot of people know zone training, like zones 0 through 5. Zone 2 is the aerobic style training, you know, just jogging out on the street. 12 METs, up to 12 METs is kind of beginner level. And so what that is if you're at 12 METs, that's what a lot of NFPA, like the Bruce protocol, requires you to work up to. And if you're a firefighter that can't work up to 12 METs, you're considered medically unable to do the job. So that's, so when you think about standards, that is the minimum standard is 12 METs now. And that's just hitting the threshold for beginner. 16 METs, you're kind of intermediate. 20 to 25 METs, that's advanced. That's kind of all out work. So Bruce protocol says you just got to get to 12. That's your low standard. And the IFC did a study where 12 METs is walking steps in gear. They also found that 16 METs is walk in full gear, breathing air, smoke conditions, like running steps, and like high rise type stuff. You might produce 16 METs, but that's in a controlled setting with no adrenaline, no rescues, no heat.
Yeah.
And so you're at 16 METs. Like you're considered intermediate, bridging, advanced now. And the cool part was that I was able to show some data, and I've got a couple presentations where I do really deep dives on that, where we're, when we talk about the max heart rate and we're talking about the METs you produce on the fire ground, this HIIT training supports that. So I had a friend who was in a wreck with entrapment. This person's a paramedic, zero gear. Yes, it was a hot day, but just from the emotion of doing RSI procedures and saving this trauma victim. So all adrenaline right now, not a lot of physical activity, 167 beats per minute. And when you adjust for age, that was like 90% of their max heart rate and they're sitting still. And so you see the emotional stress that we accumulate on these calls is already putting you at a max heart rate because of the adrenaline. Now, fast forwarding that same day, that procedure produced 11 METs. So remember, 12 METs is the low standard for being medically conditioned or deconditioned for the job. There were 1 MET away from hitting that standard and they were sitting completely still, right? They did a CrossFit workout earlier in the day that produced 8 METs. Very physically fit athlete. Later in the day, right before dinner time, they ran a house fire. They had to run 1,000 feet, pull a 400-foot attack line, did all the fire stuff. The temperature was basically 95 degrees, like high humidity. They hit 173 beats per minute. So you're looking at max heart rate and they produced over 20 METs of work. So that defies like just a bread and butter fire job.
Yeah.
The 20 METs is pretty insane, right? House fire, ran a couple months back. I produced 12 METs, peaked at 160. One of my firefighters, newer on the job, just starting their physical fitness journey, produced over 20 METs, hit 177 beats per minute, and they're younger. So a lot of physical demand on our bodies.
Fit old guy.
I'm just a fit old guy. I do talk about some data from the Baltimore City line of duty, Linden Heights for Ronaldo and Pitts. One of the captains hit a 19 strain on Whoop. So Whoop, the highest strain you can get is 21, and they hit a 19. One of their firefighters hit 20 Mets, and these are men who one of them pulled Pitts out of the structure, and another one provided EMS care for some of the firefighters on scene. So I just say all this to say there's what the textbook says, and then there's what actually is happening on real fires and real life situations, and it is far exceeding what we're seeing in these lab control settings. So the physical fitness matters because you're training your body how to be able to actually adapt to the Mets, adapt to the strain, and being able to overcome it, right? So, and the last thing I'll say for working out is you can work out on shift. A lot of people will say like, oh, well, I'll do it on my days off. The research shows that if you don't work out on shift, you're actually highly unlikely to also work out on your days off, at least consistently. And some cool research showed that if you work out on shift, there's a 9.6% decrement 15 minutes after you work out if you have to run a call, which isn't a massive shift. But basically, if you're a fit firefighter, you are faster than 70% of untrained firefighters after you exercise and run the call. And if you don't exercise and you're fresh, you're 81% faster than untrained firefighters. So basically, there is zero downside to you working out and working out on shift.
Yeah.
And I'll just kind of close it out with that. So I went through that really quickly. Hopefully I didn't burn up too much time with that. We're kind of hitting the back end of this. We've talked about cold and hot immersion. We're talking about breath work, meditation, hard, difficult workouts. Recovery is just as vital and important. So if you could start breaking down sleep, why it's so important and what good sleep hygiene looks like.
Yeah. So if, I think I said this while we were at training days, you know, if all these other things are the levels to your building, right? You are a building. A lot of analogies. You're an iceberg. You're a bucket. You're a building. But if you are a building, and meditation and fitness and nutrition and mental health are the floors of your building, the very base, the beginning structure of yourself, of your building, is sleep. Sleep dictates everything else. I read this article where they're now saying that, like anxiety and mental health used to affect your sleep. But now they're saying that actually sleep affects your mental health and can drive depression and anxiety. And so sleep is the base of all these things. If we don't have good quality sleep, then all these other things can just like go to shambles. And so when we talk about good quality sleep, we're talking about trying to go to bed around the same time at night, every night, which is hard on shift work, right? And then waking up around the same time that every week, every day, waking up around the same time. We're talking about having good sleep hygiene and what that looks like. So good sleep hygiene means we prepare for sleep at night. We turn down the lights to start affecting our, like, we calm down. We try to not have any technology in front of our faces an hour or so before we get ready to go to bed. So that means for me, like, picking up a book and reading it.
When you see all the lit up bunk room from like all the different phone screens going off, that's bad. You're telling me that's bad?
Yeah, man.
We're terrible.
Yeah, for sure. If you're looking for like a book to put you to sleep, just like grab like a hazmat book or like that will put me to sleep 100% of the time. We're talking about really dark rooms. I watched this YouTube video of this Navy SEAL instructor, and he used the term. He commented, "You want your room as dark as a trailer park in Kentucky at midnight." Like, that's how dark you want your room. We're talking about a cold environment in your room around 65 to 68 degrees. We are also, when you think about sleep hygiene, you're also talking about like setting yourself up for success. So whatever you do at night to signal to your body, okay, it's time to wind down. So you brush your teeth, you take a shower, like a hot shower. You read a book. You turn down your bed. You close your curtains. All those things signal to you and your mind and your body that, oh, okay, it's time to go to sleep, right? We're winding down. You dim the lights. Also, something that's really important is if you lay down and within 20 minutes, you're still tossing and turning, get up. Don't try and fight that sleep in your bed, because what you're teaching yourself is that it's okay to stay awake in bed. So get up and go read a book. The get up and watch TV, like, we try not to do that, but whatever helps you wind down. Obviously, when we talk about sleep, no alcohol, like an hour to two before you're getting ready to go to sleep. Alcohol, yes. Well, alcohol... I hear the guys now in my head, oh, Suzanne, like alcohol helps me wind down. Yeah, okay, sure. Alcohol does help you fall asleep. But one of the things about alcohol is that it interrupts your fourth stage of sleep, mm-hmm. which is your REM sleep, which is where we process all the bullshit that happened the day before, that all that compound stress that we just talked about that we're trying to work on dealing with. If we can't get to REM, or our REM sleep is shortened because of that alcohol, then we're really doing ourselves like a disservice. So the stages of sleep are super important. And unfortunately, we can't just jump straight to REM sleep. You have to go through all the other stages first. And all those other stages are truly affected if we decide to drink alcohol an hour to two before we go to bed.
Yeah. I noticed with Whoop that if I drink alcohol, I have at least a 14% decrement in recovery and sleep that night into the next day. Like it's, we can actually put numbers, identifiable numbers to poor sleep and quality and recovery when you drink alcohol. So I certainly feel that.
Yeah, definitely. And then another thing is, this is all well and good if you sleep at home every night. But, well, Suzanne, what if I sleep at the station? What if I'm on shift work? So here's where we start talking about when you get home, take a bit of a nap. And not like a 4 or a 5 hour or 3 hour nap. Take a bit of a nap when you can in the morning. Try and keep it before lunchtime, which is like I hear a lot of guys say, well, after I eat lunch, like I'm at home, I'm off shift, and I like to take a little nap. I feel like if that works for you and your numbers support that works for you, like if you wear some sort of sleep tracker or something like that, then yeah, sure, you know, go ahead. But what the numbers do support is that an early morning sleep is better for you. Yeah. It doesn't affect the rest of your day, and it certainly doesn't affect your nighttime sleeping, which is where we recover the most, because it's at night, it's dark, our melatonin, our natural the melatonin that we create naturally really kicks in. That's the whole point of it being dark, right? Yeah. Like, it's to signal that, which is why we want blackout curtains in a super dark room. But we're on shift work, and so we can't really help that all the time. We can't control that. And so having that early morning nap is been proven to be super helpful.
Yeah. There are some, I've talked to a sleep scientist. I've read some of the books. The lead scientist at Whoop, Kristen Holmes, would even talk about it. If you can't get to sleep throughout the day, can't get a nap in, and it's only going to happen after like 3 o'clock, they said it's like, just don't even nap, because you're going to mess up that next night of sleep even worse. So it's got to happen like, but 2 or 3, I think, was like the drop dead point. Like, it's got to happen well before that. And something else I'm a fan of is the stimulants after lunch. Like, fire service loves caffeine, right?
Yeah.
I've talked to nutritionists, like, you really shouldn't go over 400 milligrams, and we are blowing that out of the water, a lot of us.
Yeah.
And especially after lunch, it just sits in your system longer than you realize. So if you can keep it before lunch, you know, 200 to 400 milligrams, it's like 2 cups of coffee. Like, that's where we should be peeking at and try to get in before lunch. Which is tough. We're kind of wrapping this up. I closed it with, for our presentation, doing a misogi. And that's in Japanese culture, where there's two rules. It's got to be difficult, and you can't die. And what I challenge people to do in life is to find their misogi. For me, like, I love big hikes and big trips, and finding peaks and elevation, and getting to the end of it, like, working hard to earn that hike and to earn that peak. But it can be all types of physical activity, and it's generally when it's done outside and in nature, there's even more therapeutic benefits from it. But going back to kind of bringing all this full circle, it's just about choosing your heart, embracing struggle in a healthy, defined way to also prop up mental health systems, right? And it was Seneca that had a quote, "You have passed through life without an opponent. No one can ever know what you are capable of, not even you." So I know our call to action, there was a lot in there, but one of them was just know what you're capable of. And that way you don't have to second guess yourself on the fire ground, and you're a more adaptable, resilient human being on the back end of really nasty things that we experience. And when you do that, you're going to be better for it. So choose your heart, choose it wisely. If you do, it's kind of like the dichotomy of leadership with Jocko. Like, you can take everything we've just said, take it to its nth degree, and that can lead to burnout also. Like, you can't work out for 4 hours every day and sit in cold water for an hour and like do all the things to a crazy degree, because that's also going to burn you out as well. You got to find that happy medium for you, and it's going to look a little bit different for everybody. And another thing is that are you a person of character? And what I mean is, you can do all these things and you can do all the right things. If you're not being a true leader for yourself and for your people, then it's not a characteristic. All these things that you're doing are just techniques. So if you're a person of character, you have better relationships, better coping skills, higher productivity, better exercise habits, there's greater resilience. So you can do all these outward things, but in your head and what you're thinking, feeling, believing, if you're still a shitbag, pardon my language, none of this matters, right? Yeah. You have to truly live it, believe it, feel it. Because in life, things are always going to happen. You know, we have our high highs and we have our low lows. There's a quote that's behind that mountain is another mountain. You know, when things are going well, it's just a matter of time before you get rocked, right? This profession will do that to us. And something else I'll kind of close out with that I did at the presentation was a couple of weeks ago, when we were in Alexandria. You know, I'm almost 39, and there was this really cool analogy of, if you take every week of your life and draw it on a piece of graph paper, each block of that graph paper could be 1 week. And the average human being is 80 to 85 years old. And so I'm essentially halfway done. So when you actually, when you think about it, like, it's easy to visualize, but when you actually draw it out on paper and see it, half of my graph is filled up right now. And
yeah.
I'm a dad with kids. You know, I'm married to an awesome lady and I've got an awesome job. I'm surrounded by a great team with, and I get to meet amazing people. I'm sitting right across the screen from one of them.
Yo.
And I'm halfway done. Right. So I just challenge people, like, think about what that graph might look like for you. Draw out 85, you know, years of your life, and each week is a block. You know, what does that graph look like for you? What does it look like for your kids? And start to change your perspective on doing these hard things. Because we see people, you just talked about nursing homes. I got a ton in my area where there's a 60-year-old that's in the nursing home because they didn't take care of themselves.
Yeah.
And that could be our end. So I challenge you to do the right thing. I know that we had a ton of podcast and book recommendations. If you're cool with it, we made an outline where we took all this information and dropped it in, so it was easily to digest information. And so you can totally email us if you want that. I wanted you to be able to close this out. We've covered a lot. It was a wide cast net, but we wanted to get as much information out there to help build that resiliency, right? So I'll leave the floor to you to close it out
for
anything that we've missed or whatever. Because this really started with you and your experiences with your department. And I know this, you've been on the grind for 4+ years, like, trying to fight the good fight. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, first off, like, just again, what an honor to be on here with you. I know you're doing some amazing things yourself, and I really appreciate you inviting me on here, because in the end, my goal is to spread the word of just trying to take care of yourself and take care of the people around you. And whatever that looks like for you, for the folks that are listening to your awesome podcast, right? We have to start breaking that stigma that mental health is not something that we should brush under the rug. I know during the presentation that we did, I talked about an amazing captain that I had. He's retired now, living his best life. But I always knew that he was a really strong leader. He was a strong captain, a strong officer. He's still, a strong friend. And I just chatted with him yesterday, getting some advice from him. And, I realized how strong he was when he reached out for help himself. And to have that role model, to recognize that even the strongest people need help and need assistance as well, that was a huge learning life lesson for me. And so the stigma is real, and it's up to us to continue to fight that stigma, because only by letting people know that it's okay to reach out and work on yourself and get help will we end suicide and end mental health struggles and having people feel like they have to fight it on their own and that they can't reach out. Pay attention to your people and the people around you, and don't be afraid to reach out if you're struggling or you need help, whoever that looks like for you. Yeah, that was it.
No, that's an amazing way to wrap things up. I appreciate your time. Thank you for including me in on this project. It was really cool to be in the place that we were, in the environment that we were, with Training Days to be able to put out the good word. That's such a massive honor with them and their team. And Yeah, if this is something that you're interested in, I mean, please reach out to either one of us for more information. Like I said, we created an outline with all this information, with all the research supporting it, in a really easy to read format. So I won't even try to put our emails out there. I'll put them in the show notes. So if that's something you're interested in, reach out to one of us and we'll get that to you. The more information, the better. So, but yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you.